And we'll get you out of here at 9 o'clock. Your time is valuable, and I want to show respect for you on that. We're going to start this time. We've been dealing with observation, and we're going to be going to interpretation. We're still on to what does it mean in their town part, step one. And so we've done, like I say, the observation. We're going to interpretation, and we'll do half of it now and half of it 9 in the morning on interpretation. Then we'll get into the next, preparation, and then presentation. And the question we have to ask is who... That's not what I want up there. What is that? That's not even the right one. Well, yes, it is. That will do. Okay, we're good. Let me share with you some sermons that I have come across recently on different topics. This one is an older sermon. I'm going to give you some new sermons. This was actually preached by Origen, a 3rd century church father from North Africa. And he is preaching on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And here is how he preached the Good Samaritan. The traveler, who is Adam, journeys from Jerusalem, which represents heaven, to Jericho, which is the world, and is assaulted by robbers, which represent the devil and his helpers. The priest, which is symbolic of the law, and the Levite, which represents the prophets, pass by without aiding fallen Adam. But the Samaritan, who is Christ, stops to help and sets him on his beast, which is his own body, and brings him to the inn, which is the church, giving the innkeeper 2 denarii, which represent the Father and the Son, and promise to come back, which represents Jesus' second coming. That's creative, isn't it? The question comes, when Jesus gave the parable of the Good Samaritan, was that what Jesus was communicating? He just asked the rich young ruler, he just, what do I have to do? And Jesus talked about loving God and loving his neighbor. And then the Good Samaritan, or not the Good Samaritan, the rich young ruler says, who is my neighbor? This whole parable of the Good Samaritan was answering the question in the context, who is my neighbor? And he gives the parable of the Good Samaritan, which you can sum up this, your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need you're able to meet. I mean, that's what the Good Samaritan is. Who's my neighbor? Your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need you're able to meet. Okay? But that's not the way Origen saw it. Now I'm going to give you another one. These are recent interpretations, all of them of David and Goliath. One sees David as a type of Jesus, and Goliath as a picture of Satan. Since Goliath is wearing scale armor, scales obviously indicate the serpent, that Goliath represents the serpent of old, Satan. Once again, there's a serpent in the garden, the land of Israel. David is seen as the new Adam that Israel has been waiting for, that is the Christ. He is the beastmaster, taking dominion over bears and lions and now fighting the serpent. Is that what was meant when Samuel wrote about this in 1 Samuel? Is that what the original author intended to communicate to the original audience? But there are people out there preaching that. That's a modern-day sermon. Here's another one. Modern-day, the same story, teaching about that Goliath is not necessarily literal. This is all figurative. And Goliath represents the giants in your life. Now, David defeated the giant in his life, and you can defeat the giants in yours too. Third interpretation. Goliath isn't a person at all. He's an ideology. Goliath represents a system of racial bias that we as whites have inherited from our forefathers and continue to perpetuate. David represents anyone who has the courage to stand up against systemic racism. Three interpretations, three recent interpretations of the same story in the Bible. The question we have to ask is, did God and the original human authors intend that historical event of David and Goliath to be understood in any of those ways. Why are those being preached as sermons? Is that really the intent? And am I doing justice? Am I representing God well by simply coming up with my own interpretations and applications? When we want to know what God intended in this David and Goliath thing, he tells us in the context. David accuses Goliath of taunting the living God. Goliath wants to have a contest to see who rules the land. If Goliath defeats the Israelites, you become our slaves. If he defeats us, we'll become your slaves. Did God intend for that to be the way things went? God had given Israel the land, hadn't he? But Goliath is taunting the living God. And here's what David says the purpose of all this is. He says, I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth. Why? That all the earth may know that there's a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. The purpose of this is just stated right there in the passage, isn't it? That's not what any of these modern interpreters have come to. And what we are seeing today, and you have to be very, very careful, people are reading passages through different grids. They're reading them through theological grids. I know one fellow, good guy, I like the guy, but every passage is about the sovereignty of God. And he is going to preach a message on the sovereignty of God from every passage. Now, is God sovereign? Absolutely. Was God sovereign in the story of Jonah? Absolutely. God is sovereign. Is that passage about primarily God's sovereignty? It's a part of the picture, but it's certainly not the purpose of the story. But he gets stuck on the sovereignty of God, and every message is the same. And I believe in the sovereignty of God, and the things he's saying are true, but that's certainly not the point of the passages that he's getting it from. Some read the Bible through the story of redemptive history. Everything's about salvation. Others read it through a Christocentric hermeneutic, and that everything is about Jesus. And I've even seen the tent pegs in the tabernacle interpreted. One of them says that Jesus is the tent peg in the tabernacle. He, as a tent peg, kept the tabernacle secured. You are secure by Jesus. He's that tent peg picture of Jesus. Another says, no. Those tent pegs represent the spikes driven into Jesus' hands and his feet. And then he goes off and waxes eloquently about the tent pegs actually being symbolic representative of Jesus' crucifixion. I don't see anywhere in the Bible where it interprets the tent pegs in the tabernacle as representing that, do you? Where do they come up with that? It's really a creative imagination. It's certainly not from the context. Woke pastors read everything through the grid of critical theory. Everything they read in the Bible involves an oppressed and an oppressor. It may be racial, it may be gender, it may be economic, it may be physical, it may be emotional, but everything is seen as being an answer to the issue of critical theory, the conflict between the oppressed and the oppressor. And so everything's interpreted through that. I know some others who, a couple of theologians have recently come out and said, everything must be read through the creeds. Every passage has to be read through the creeds. So rather than letting the passage speak for itself, people start with presuppositions and they read the passage through their presuppositions. And we have to be very, very careful. We don't do that. Okay? If there's time, the last session on Saturday, I'm going to be talking about secret Bible codes and hidden meanings and biblical genealogies and numerology and equidistant lettering sequencing and all of this stuff that you're reading out there, people go out there all excited about, which I'm going to show you why each of them is baloney. And I'm not trying to be nasty or whatever. They mislead people. They were not the intent of the author, and we'll see that the last hour, assuming I keep on schedule. Okay. In fact, if you see, you don't see it in your book, I have it called bonus. If I get done on time, you get the bonus. Okay. So, anyhow, what have we seen We want to know what was the original intent of the author as he wrote to the original audience, and then we relate it to us. And we've already seen this. We've been dealing with this right here. We're still there. We did all of our observations quickly, and then we have not gotten into interpretation yet, but we're going to get into interpretation now. We've written down all kinds of questions and things that come up, what we need to know, and by diagramming it, it brings some other questions up. And so we've gone through this, and here are the steps of observation. The third one, which I didn't have you do, is write down key observations and questions that you'll later look up in your research. Okay? Now, we're going to, observation is what it says. Interpretation is what does it mean? And to understand what it means, we need to understand it within its historical, cultural, literary, and personal context. And what do I mean by that? Historical, cultural, who was the author and who were the original recipients? Why is the author writing? Your observation should show a lot of that. What circumstances do the recipients face? It'll help you in your interpretation. That's why I read it so many times and made so many observations. And we saw what they were facing, tremendous suffering in various forms. What historical, cultural elements should we know to understand the passage? The geographical, cultural, social customs, worldview, and so forth. I'm going to just throw this one out here. Exodus chapter 21, verses 7 to 11, allow a father to sell his daughter into slavery. Jared, you have a daughter. Don't you want to know the historical, cultural setting? Okay, what does it mean by slavery? Okay, what does the Bible say about that culturally? And as you look at the historical cultural setting, what happened when people were too poor to care for their children? There was indentured servanthood. Those girls were not to be sexually abused, and if there was any sexual activity, the guy had to marry her, and he couldn't divorce her, or she was freed. And there was consequences. There was not any of that. That was totally not permitted. My Irish relatives came over during the potato famine. There were between 1 and 2 million Irish died of starvation during the potato famine. There was in Ireland so many orphaned kids, it was unbelievable. The British took three full shiploads of 14-year-old girls to Australia because it had been a penal colony and none of those men had wives, and they took them over there. Why? Somebody had to take care of them if they were a wife. Now, I think it was terrible. I think that's a lousy thing to do. The Bible certainly doesn't justify that. But how do you deal with it in that culture? You know, in my relatives, they sent what they called indentured servanthood. They signed a contract. I will go to work in a textile factory, I will go to work in the forest or on the railroad or whatever for a period of a designated period up to 7 years. You will take care of my food and my housing and my clothing and my need for that period of time, and often a minimal salary. But I am your servant. I belong to you for 7 years, until my passage is paid for. And it also takes care of my upkeep. We have in our safe at home a big document of a girl who had was an indentured servant. And it's an official document. It's rolled up. It looks very official, well written, as only they did in those days, of her agreement to come over here and to work. And Diane, how many years was she to work? She was to work for a definite period of time, and it was an indentured slave, they called it. We call it indentured servanthood now. It was called an indentured slave, but it's not slavery as we think of it. Okay, and that was what was true at that time. But if you read about that in Exodus, about dads, you can sell your daughters into slavery, you better know the historical context, hadn't you? You'd better understand the cultural context, hadn't you? You'd better understand the limitations within the historical cultural context, hadn't you? And so we want to do that when we read a passage in the Bible, whether it's criminal justice, there's just a lot of things. There are a lot of places you can go. You don't want to know the religions, what are the religious implications. You read about people eating meat sacrificed to idols. What's the significance of that? What did it mean in the culture? What is that all about? You want to know that, don't you, if you're going to accurately understand it and explain it. And I put down just a number of examples of tools, and you have a list of those. You have this same chart in your book. And those are just examples. There are a lot of other possibilities. Some are even better. So just in case you have a question of where you can go for various tools to look up different stuff. You want to know the literary context. What is the literary genre? Are you dealing with narrative material? Are you dealing with poetry, wisdom literature? Is it a letter? Is it prophecy? Each tends to use a certain type of forms of structure. Wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is not meant to be promises in the Bible. They're maxims or generalities. For instance, I have had so many parents who've been so disappointed. The Bible says, train up a child in the way which he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. And they claim that as if it was a promise. I know I raised my kid for Christ, and he's gone off the rails, but you know, I have that promise in the Bible, he's going to come to Christ. Well, a maxim or wisdom letter is not giving you a promise, it's giving you general principles of life. Every culture has these principles that they tend to hand down in this type of way. For instance, growing up, my dad always used to say, a penny saved is a penny earned. A stitch in time says nine, my mother used to say. Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. What if you have to work the midnight shift? Okay, I'd rather not have a job than do that. You'd be poor. Anyhow, the bottom line is, these are what you're calling general principles of life. They're maxims. They're not promises. So when you're teaching Proverbs, you don't grab a proverb and say, this is a promise. No, this is a general principle of life, okay? And we can give you many, many examples of it. So you need to know what kind of literature you're dealing with. Poetic literature. Poetry uses a lot of figures of speech, whether you're talking about English or you're talking about Hebrew. And Hebrew uses various forms of parallelism, just like any poetry does. That includes synonymous parallelism, where the second line is saying the same thing as the first one in just a little different way. It's not. It's the same thing, just stated in a different way. You have antithetical parallelism, where the second line is stating the opposite of what the first line says. You have synthetic parallelism, where the second line is developing further the first line. And then you have acrostic, which I won't get into all. You have at least seven different forms that Hebrew poetry uses. And so when you're interpreting something, you don't automatically assume the second line is giving you something totally different. It may be simply explaining the first line. You need to look at them very carefully. We have then prophetic literature. Prophetic literature uses a lot of word pictures, use similes and metaphors. A simile is this is like this, or this is as that. They're talking about similarities. They didn't say this is that. Metaphors are like similes, except it doesn't use the word as or like, but you know it's describing it. For instance, when you're talking about the dragon in the book of Revelation, is it really a multi-headed dragon? Or is the dragon representing something else? Do you take it literally or you take it figuratively? In that case, you take it figuratively, and yet, in fact, the passage itself, as it's developed, explains to you that it is a metaphor. It is a figure of speech. It is a symbolic representation. And we just need to read, depending on the type of literature we're reading, we need to understand the general principles. Just like when we do in English, we automatically know that. You know, If I said, you know, my car is a real dog, you're not going to go out there and think my wife and I rode down here from northern Idaho on a Great Dane. You know, you would know when I say my car is a real dog that I, and it's not, by the way. But if I said that, you'd say, you know, it's a pathetic car, you know, it's on its last leg type thing. But we use figures of speech all the time, don't we, in English? And we know these principles, and we know when we read English poetry, or we listen to English wisdom literature, we know the rules of that type of literature. And we call them rules, they're just general principles. And Hebrew and Greek do the same thing. And so we need to be careful we understand that. Then we need to look at the context immediately before and after. So many things are taken out of context. I mentioned before, and Hezekiah turned to the wall. We just needed to read the rest of the verse before and the verse after and the rest of the verse. But let me, here's one. People, this is in the Bible, believe it or not. This is in the Bible. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. It's in the Bible. How do you deal with it? What? You read the context. In fact, already in Ecclesiastes, several times before this, chapter 2, chapter 5, basically say that this is a lousy philosophy of life. So what's the context of this? Well, if you look at it, it says, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness." So the context is already telling you some basic principles. He goes on and says, he says, "Though through sloth the roof sinks and through indolence the house leaks, bread is made for laughter and wine gladdens the heart and money is the answer to everything." In the context, what he's saying is these young, unqualified rulers, instead of being wise like those who eat in moderation properly and don't get drunk and who are careful, these guys think, hey, it's party time, we're going to enjoy these offices. And it says they let the roof sag. That is, the idea is the country falls apart because of neglect. But they say, it's okay, taxes are the solution to everything. That's the context. They're just saying, hey, they're lousy leaders, but you know, all we have to do is raise taxes. That's the context. So you need to look at the context, don't you? Okay. So what do we do here? Well, you look at, first of all, at the passage itself, and then you look in the immediate context. The immediate context on this one destroys it. Then you look at the rest of the book. The rest of the book argues against that philosophy several places. The larger context in the rest of the book, obviously the Bible doesn't support it. So you need to make sure you look at context. You need to look at context. If you have a statement like that one, you know, hey, eat, drink, and be merry, and money is the ultimate goal in life. If you read a passage like that, maybe you should look at the context, hadn't you? Then we need to look at another context. Why did the author include this section in the book? What difference would it make if we removed this section from the book? In other words, it's there for a reason. Why is it there? How does it fit in what's being said in the passage and in the book? Then we need to look at personal context, and this is a big one. The idea here is what might cause a person like you and me to be biased against a particular understanding. And there are a lot of things that we personally react to various things in the Bible for a number of reasons. We want to interpret the Bible through our own personal experiences, our personal opinions, and our personal desires, and whatever might be in our personal self-interest. And this is not, this is understandable. For instance, if a woman was in an abusive relationship, either growing up or with a husband, she'll read a passage which talks about submission, and that word is a trigger word, and it's going to cause all kinds of emotional reaction, as you would expect. And so what we want to do is totally reinterpret it. Or if you're in a feminist world like we are today, when it talks about difference in role, men and women are of equal value before God, equal in salvation, equal as a child of God, but God has different roles, you're going to react against that naturally. But there are other things. You come with different opinions. Our culture is educating you in some things. I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm not even going to answer them. When you think of a newborn baby, is that baby basically good? Is that baby basically bad? Or is that baby neutral? If a person has problems, is it primarily a biological problem? Is it a cultural, environmental problem? Is it mental illness, or is it related to the sin nature? And how do we put those together? What is the solution to people's problems? Primarily medical, primarily cultural and environmental? Or our primary issue deal with sin, and then how do they relate? What is the line between victimhood and personal responsibility? Social justice. Is justice equal result or equal opportunity? All of these things, and I'm not going to answer them, but how you, and there are right answers, by the way. I would love to deal with this. By the way, there are physical and biological issues, but I want to make this statement, and this is going to, if what we're being told today is true, then Jesus left his followers totally ill-equipped to deal with their deepest and most personal problems until the advent of psychology in the 60s and the discovery of psychiatric drugs in the 70s. For 2,000 years, Jesus said we had no hope. Now, we have to address the real issues of life, but we also have to maybe have a little different perspective on how we address the issues of life. I'd love to talk about it. I'm sure somebody's going to nail me at the coffee pot, and that's fine, okay? But it's just something to think about. It's something to think about, okay? We come down here to suffering. Peter's all about suffering. We might react to 1 Peter. How can a loving God allow his people to suffer? That can't mean what it's saying, so we have to reinterpret it, right? That God sometimes wants us to suffer? If our understanding of suffering is that suffering is all bad, and God only wants you to be happy, healthy, and wealthy, then somehow you have to deal with these passages in 1 Peter that talk about suffering sometimes being necessary and sometimes being for our benefit. Anyhow, we have to look at ourselves in these things. This next one, I'm going to do this. I got 15 minutes, and I think we can do it, and this is going to be more exciting than the last section. We're going to talk about meaning. What is the meaning of key words? And this is where a lot of people really, really, really mess up. And the meaning of key words. And a lot of pastors mess up here. A lot of you will mess up here in your personal Bible studies. Here are some fallacies that people make in word studies. They assume that the real meaning of a word is found in the original root, in the original Greek root or the original Hebrew root. It doesn't work, but I'm going to give you a couple of English examples to show you it doesn't work. Let's take the word butterfly. Let's go to the root. It's a yellow cube of bread spread with wings. It's butterfly. Can you do that by going to the root, come up with the right definition? Let's take another one. Pineapple. Is it a special kind of apple that only grows on pine trees? We know that it doesn't work in English, but people, pastors do that all the time. Let's go to the Greek. The Greek says this and this, and so therefore it means... No. Usage is how you determine the meaning of a word. The meaning can be, the root can be helpful at times, but don't automatically assume a word is defined by the root. It is defined by the context in which it is used throughout the Bible and other literature. So just be careful. Don't get caught up on that one. Here's another one. I told you this was going to be fun. Here's another one. Don't insist that a word must have the same meaning every time it occurs. On this one, I'm going to say a word here, and I'm going to want you to give me the first thing you think of when I say this word. Just hold it yourself, and then you can tell me. Are you ready? I'm going to say a word, and the first thing that comes into your mind, grab it. Spring. Okay. What did you think of, Kelly? Okay, a coil. Okay. Somebody else think of something else?
The season right after winter.
The season. Somebody think of something else?
Water.
A spring of water. Okay. There's another thing. It's when I was younger, I used to be able to spring up and down. Okay. Okay, we have the English word spring, right? And the English word spring, depending on its context, can mean a number of things. The same thing is true with Greek and Hebrew words. Okay. Here's something else. Remember that a word in Greek and Hebrew is often translated into English by a number of different words. And this can be a problem. For example, I mentioned the NIV. It takes the Greek word paraklesis and translates it with 11 different English words. Now, the same Greek word translated by 11 different English words. That's a problem to me, particularly as I mentioned that passage in Roman, you had the same Greek word translated by 3 different English words in a matter of 3 verses. That's a problem. Actually, 2 verses. For instance, they translate comfort, exhort, preach urgently, and so forth. Here's another problem. Remember that different words in the Hebrew and English can be translated in English using the same English word. I went to Russia over a number of years, and for over a period of 10 years, and taught pastors over there on modular classes. And it was interesting, the translators would say to me, I tend to repeat things in different ways to help people understand using different words, synonyms. And my translator says, please don't, we don't have that many synonyms for that word in Russian. I don't have words to, you know. But sometimes we can in a language, and so how do I put it? Here's another example from the NIV. It uses the word comfort to translate 6 different Greek words. The Greek has 6 different words. The NIV translates it comfort every time. Okay, so we just need to be recognized. We want to understand what what it means in the original, and we'll be talking about how do I look at the range of meaning within the original and determine what it means in a given passage. This is for those of you who want to dig deep. Okay. Three basic steps in a word study. Choose your words. What words in the passage that I am studying are important? For instance, 1 Peter, the word elect is used. Exiles is used. Foreknowledge is used. You may want to choose those or some other ones. What words do you want? Then you need to go and understand, okay, here are the words. I want to understand what the word could mean in the original language. And you can find the original language by going to your computer, most of you. And there are programs that can do this. I have a program that all I have to do is put my cursor on the English word, and it'll show me what Greek word is used. And then on the side, it gives me the various ways that that word is translated in the language, not only in the Bible, but in other Greek things. So I have all of that just by putting my cursor there. Not all of you have that program, okay? But you can get something as simple as Strong's Concordance. Look up the word in Strong's Concordance in the passage you're using, and it'll have a little number there. And you take that number to the back, and it will give you the range of meaning and the definition of that particular word. So you know what it can mean, like the word spring. Okay, we look at spring, we take the how spring can be translated, what it can represent in the English. Okay, so I know here's how it can be used. And now let's see in the context how it is used. Okay, context determines which of the options is possible. So you first of all look up the options, what it could mean in the Greek or the Hebrew, and then you go in your context and see in the English, which in the context, which of those three or four possibilities does it mean right here? Okay, that's for those who don't have Greek and Hebrew, and I don't imagine many of you in here do, and so we're not talking about that. So if you're really wanting a deep study, that's what you can do. And there's Vine's Dictionary of Old Testament, New Testament Words, and so forth. A lot of software programs available. And here's the other part. Determine what the word does mean in the context. That's the important part. So what have we seen tonight? We want to know what our passage, what God is trying to communicate to people in our generation. That's why we study. So we want to take a look at it. We take a passage and we make all the observations we can and write questions as we see. Okay. Well, maybe in the small passage, then after I've read the whole book, my passage, okay. If I outline it, it can be helpful. That's why I outline it. It can be helpful for me to understand what it means. That's why I do it. It also brings up questions I have, okay? And if there are words that I need to understand the meaning of, there are ways for me to help understand the word. And I need to be very careful that I don't make wrong assumptions. And that's what I was trying to point out earlier. Make sure you don't use those wrong assumptions because you really want to understand the word. Now, tomorrow morning we have the big crescendo. We're going to take what we've seen tonight and we're going to define what is and learn how to define what is that core idea. What is that central idea? What is that big idea? By the way, those are all synonyms describing the same thing. What is the big idea that God is communicating in the passage? And we're going to do that in the morning, first thing out of the shoot. So we'll find out which one of you can get out of bed on time. Okay. Bo, first of all, any questions? Tomorrow we're going to do a lot of things. We're going to come up with a big idea. We're going to see how it bridges over the central idea, then check it, and then we're going to talk about how to have really practical application. Many of us as teachers are lousy with applications. We get some generality and we throw it out there and it really is a truism that doesn't strike home with our people. It really doesn't get down into their skin where they live. They really don't. How do we draw applications, genuine applications, legitimate applications from the text? And how do we apply it to our audience, whether it's a group of junior hires or whether it's a group of college students? How do we do that? And how do we handle a passage? So we're going to talk tomorrow, finish up interpretation, come up with a big idea. We're going to cross over, and we're going to come up with application. And then we're going to come to how you put together the message itself. How you put it actually, or the lesson itself, using the things you've learned. And then we're going to talk about presentation. How can I best present this? Well, today we're going to talk about 1 Peter. Aren't all of you interested in talking about 1 Peter? Let me talk about 1 Peter. Let me tell you what the Romans were doing at that period of time. Let me tell you, you know, is that going to grab you? How many are you going to check out within the first 30 seconds? Okay. How can you help the people from the very beginning, and how can you communicate it in a way, present it effectively? So we're going to be dealing with that. So anyhow, Bo, would you close us in prayer?